Welcome to X Squared Radio, my friends. This is Brooks Agnew, your host. Sorry for the late start. Had some technical difficulties. No worries. We got them solved.
The spice extends life.
We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the earth.
The spice expands consciousness.
We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear.
The spice is vital to space travel.
You will be safely traveling with us. Whether you're driving across the frozen tundra tonight or working on your favorite project, you are about to discover more about who we are, why we are here, and where we may be going than you thought possible. Recline your chair, look out the window, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. There is quite a bit in the news tonight, but my most important announcement, you must not miss it. We have a congressional candidate coming on the program tonight. His name is Richard Lynch. He's a member of the GO movement. You know what the GO movement is, right? Get out of our house. It's powerful stuff. You don't want to miss it. So this is a special edition of X Squared Radio. We have some information for you tonight that you must have. You need to call your friends now and get them to tune in. I'm sorry for not alerting you earlier, but this is unfolding as we speak, and you need to know this. We are live, coming to you from east of the Appalachian Mountains, an undisclosed location. Our AccuWindow forecast is unseasonably warm, and it's dark outside. It's as far as I'm going to go with it. It's as much as you need to know. Really quick, don't forget about Maya 2012. Go to the orange banner at X Squared Radio. Click on that. Join me at Chichen Itza. And if you don't want to fly to Mexico, you don't want a passport, don't worry. We have a special conference just for you right in the Midwest. You can drive to it. It's called the Pythagoras Conference. There'll be 50 speakers at this conference. Nothing like it has ever taken place in the Midwest. West Coast, yes. New York, yes. In the Midwest, never. This is the first time. So you'll have a chance to join us and to hear some great speakers and be empowered for what to do in these, what some are calling the latter days. If you want to be part of the program tonight, and I strongly suggest that you participate, our toll-free number anywhere in North America is 888-429-5471. Those of you that have Droid phones, you may use the Droid app at xsquaredradio.com. Just click on it, and you will instantly be launched into X Squared Radio on Channel 2 of BBS Radio Network. We're working on the app. We're going to put some more sophisticated features into it, like you could be walking along, drinking milk and eating cookies, minding your own business, listening to X Squared Radio, and you may feel strongly compelled to call in. No worries. You just pull out your phone, press a button on the app while it's running live, and it will dial the studio automatically. You don't have to stop listening to the program. You can jump right in. And join us. Those features are coming. We're getting better at it down here at the technical service wing of X Squared Radio. Don't forget, if you're just tuning in, Richard Lynch, a congressional candidate in the state of, in the 9th District of North Carolina, is coming on the program tonight. He is strong. He's organized. He's in the 9th District. We're here to familiarize you with how things are about to change in government. One of the social phenomenon that we have discussed in recent weeks is the energy of national protest. I am in the process of sending to print my latest book. It's called Alienated Nation. The website will be up by the end of the week. You will be able to pre-order the book just like before. You'll get a discount if you pre-order the book. It will be available in audio, and you will get the audio version for free, as is customary with all the books that I release, with the exception of Volume 3 of The Ark of Millions of Years. I never got that one out. long book. In any case, you need to have this book in your hands before you go vote. You need to know this stuff. The energy of protest went out from Ron Paul in 2007 during his run for the presidency. It was so powerful that it did some amazing things that seemed to take on a life of their own. The first thing to happen was the formation of the Tea Party movement. That has really taken on a life of its own, but it's largely been hijacked by the Republicans. And it's taken on some derogatory connotations. They've become lost in the game of politics. And except for Ron Paul, it is difficult to tell one candidate from the others. The next thing to happen was as that energy went out, it went across the world. And it coalesced in Egypt January of 2011. And that was the first protest in Egypt. And then the ripples of that energy for the last year went all around the world. We're seeing it in Spain, we're seeing it in Turkey, we're seeing it in Russia, and finally it came back home to the U.S., and it took on three major forms. The first is the Occupy movement. It's filled our city parks. There's news tonight from New York that some of the renewed energy because of the warm weather is beginning to form again. And I've got a story on that I'm going to read to you in just a couple of minutes. Needless to say, the police were quick to move in, bust heads, and arrest people. And they have really put the foot on the neck of the Occupy people, and they say they will be back tomorrow night. The second is the motivation of 32 states to pass sovereignty acts to declare state independence from the federal government. Now, this is so powerful. I cannot go into everything tonight, but I'm going to go into something so powerful and so amazing. It took place literally the day before yesterday. You may not have heard about it. It is so sweeping and so powerful, it will send shockwaves from this radio broadcast tonight around the world. The third is the formation of the GO movement. That is Get Out of Our House, G-O-O-H, Get Out of Our House movement. It was started by the guy who wrote the book Throw Them All Out, revealed a lot of insider trading, a lot of shenanigans going on, with, especially with long-term congressional and senatorial leaders. And tonight we have Richard Lynch coming on as a leading candidate in North Carolina to talk about that movement. He is eloquent. He is well-spoken. You can ask him questions. I'm going to ask him questions. And you're going to find out about this movement and how in your state, I guarantee you, there are GO candidates running. You can do something about this. Now, the following stories are indications that the states and their citizens are mad as hell, and they're not going to take it anymore. I'm not taking that from a movie. I'm just telling you. You may recall that just before the war between the states, or as we say in the Deep South, the recent unpleasantness, there was only one territory that was occupied by the Union, and that was Fort Sumter. On April 11th of 1861, three Confederate officers rowed a boat across the foggy bay, about 3 miles with a white flag, to the fort to offer the commanding officer safe passage for him, his 87 officers, and all of his troops and all their supplies out of the fort and out of Charleston, out of Southern territory. With thanks for the honorable gesture, he refused. The South proceeded to bombard the fort for 32 hours, killing no one inside the fort. Well, they surrendered, and they were escorted out of Southern territory. The details are described in fresh and powerful correlation in my new book, Alienated Nation, which will be in print next month. You'll be able to buy it next month from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and especially from our website, alienatednation.com. And when you buy from that website, you will get the audio for free. So if you're not a good reader, don't worry about it. I will have read it for you. Well, the same thing happened this week in all places, Florida. Whatever you do tonight, do not tune away from tonight's program. Something very big is starting right here, and you are traveling with us. So here we go. Major U.S. airport in Orlando, Orlando-Sanford International, is one of America's busiest airports. Lots of people from outside the country fly in there. Lots of people fly out of Orlando and go all over the world. It will opt out of using TSA workers to screen passengers. That's right. TSA agents are being ejected from the airport. Now, the president of the airport said Tuesday of this week that he would apply again to use private operators to screen passengers using federal standards and oversight. So they're not going to do what Texas did. Texas, under the order of Rick Perry, the governor of Texas, the longest-serving governor in the United States, said they were going to stop doing pat-downs. They were intrusive, they were making Texans mad, and they weren't going to do it anymore. So the federal government clamped down as hard as it could and said, that's fine, but no one will be able to fly out of Texas. You can fly around Texas and land back in Texas, but you can't leave Texas because you're not going to enter secure airspace unless you've been patted down. So that was shut down in a hurry. The state decided to capitulate. Florida's doing it differently. Florida's saying, oh, we're pat down, we'll search, but we will do it with our own people. With Sanford International having originally been prevented by the TSA from opting out back in November of 2010, when the federal agency froze the ability for airports to use their own private screeners, a law passed by the Senate last month forces the TSA to reconsider applications. This is big, people. Really, really big. Larry Dale hinted that the move was motivated by the innumerable horror stories passengers have told of their encounters with the TSA, noting that the change was designed to provide a more customer-friendly operation. The agency has been slow to reissue the guidelines on the rule change, prompting Republican Representatives John Mica of Florida, Daryl Issa of California, and Jason Chaffetz of Utah to press TSA head John Pistole to implement the mandate. Appearing at Orlando International yesterday, Mica said he had written to 200 airports advising them of the opportunity to opt out of using TSA screeners. Orlando Sanford is in the top 30 busiest airports in the world. Forget about the United States. The TSA has been keen to downplay the opportunity for airports to dispense with their screeners, fearing a mass exodus that could undermine the justification for the agency's continued existence, especially the fact that its reputation has been repeatedly savaged by a number of scandals. Well, that is huge news because there will be a mass exodus. The TSA agents will be ejected from the entire state of Florida. Texas will follow, and other states right behind them. What you will see is that the TSA agents are going to be out of work. And if the TSA agents are out of work, a large piece of muscle of the Homeland Security Department agency, overseers, will have been emasculated. With airports out of the way, it's only a matter of time before bus stations, train stations, and yes, highways. The TSA is now screening highways. will all be out of a job. States are taking over the responsibility for their own airports again, kicking out the incompetent, criminally inclined, and abusive TSA across the nation will not only encourage millions of peeved Americans to start flying again, pumping much-needed money into the travel industry, it will also create thousands of new private sector jobs. Yes, well, the feds, if you'll remember, West Yellowstone Airport in Montana has already replaced its TSA screeners with private security. Burt Mooney Airport, also in Montana, is attempting to do the same. However, when Texas lawmakers attempted to do it, the feds threatened to implement a blockade. Does that sound familiar? A blockade. Well, this is just the tip, people, just the tip. The Occupy movement is going to regroup due to unseasonably warm weather, and you've already seen that in New York. It is going to be everywhere. It's going to be across the Midwest. It's going to be in Chicago. It's going to be in New York, and it will raise the skill level of the entire Midwest operation. So the breaking news, and we're going to bring Richard Lynch on here in 6 minutes, but the breaking news, this just occurred 2 days ago. It actually, the press release was done yesterday, but it actually passed on March 16th. And by passed, I use the term loosely because this is an executive order. Are you ready for this? Listen, normally I don't require you to wear a seatbelt for this program, but you better grab a hold of something. This is really powerful stuff. Here we go. By the authority vested in me as president, by the Constitution and the laws of the United States of America, including the Defense Production Act of 1950, and Section 301 of Title III United States Code, and as Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces of the United States, it is hereby ordered as follows. Do I have your attention? Here is the purpose. This order delegates authorities and addresses national defense resource policies and programs under the Defense Production Act of 1950. I'm sure you don't know what that is. So that is why you are listening to this program. I happen to have it. The Defense Production Act of 1950 is a United States law enacted on September 8th, 1950, before most of you were born, certainly before I was born, in response to the start of the Korean War. It was part of a broad civil defense and war mobilization effort in context of the Cold War. The Act contains three major sections. The first authorizes the president to require businesses to sign contracts or fulfill orders of deemed necessary for national defense. The second authorizes the president to establish mechanisms such as regulations, orders, or agencies to allocate materials, services, and facilities to promote national defense. The third section authorizes the president to control the civilian economy so that scarce and or critical materials necessary to the national defense effort are available for defense needs. Oh, yeah, one more thing. The Act also authorizes the president to requisition property, force industry to expand production and the supply of basic resources, impose wage and price controls, settle labor disputes, control consumer and real estate credit, establish contractual priorities, and allocate raw materials to aid the national defense. Pay close attention to wage and price controls. So, this is an executive order that goes beyond the pale, people. Beyond the pale. Here's the policy. In about 3 minutes, we have Richard Lynch coming on with us. The reason I'm reading the policy of this executive order is because this is fresh, brand new, executive order that was signed into law, going around Congress, going around the Senate, going around the Supreme Court. The president is making this happen as we speak. The United States must have an industrial and technological base capable of meeting national defense requirements and capable of contributing to the technological superiority of its national defense equipment in peacetime and in times of national emergency. The domestic industrial and technological base is the foundation for national defense preparedness. Now, executive departments and agencies responsible for plans and programs relating to national defense or for resources and services needed to support such plans and programs shall. That's a big word when it comes to new laws. Shall be prepared in the event of a potential threat to the security of the United States to take actions necessary to ensure the availability of adequate resources and production capability, including services of critical technology for national defense requirements. Oh, it goes on and on. There are 14 pages to this. I'm not going to read them all, but it's so powerful and so sweeping. It takes the National Defense Act of 1950 and expands it, expands the authority of the president to be able to command government from his office using the following delegates. Now, this is really going to irk you, but it's okay. That's we'll bring you back. Richard is with us. He's listening. The Defense Production Act Committee shall be composed of the following members. I know you're not going to find a member of Congress, and you're not going to find a member of the Senate in here. There are 17. The Secretary of State, Treasury, Defense, Attorney General, Interior, Agriculture, Commerce, Labor, Health and Human Services, Transportation, Energy, Homeland Security, Director of National Intelligence, the CIA, the Council of Economic Advisors, NASA, GSA, the General Services Administration, and the Director of the Office of Science and Technology Policy. That is who the executive branch commands. There is no representation there. There are no elected officials there. All of these people are appointed by the president, and they are implementing this brand new executive order. Again, the executive order is called the National Defense Resources Preparedness Act. It is a modification of an act that's been in place since the Korean War. It was established in September of 1950, called the Defense Production Act. But it is hugely expanding the authority by just the president in all of these areas. All right. Now we're going to go into what's happening with our Congress, what's happening with taxes. I know you're interested in this. Please welcome with me Richard Lynch. Welcome, sir.
How are you doing tonight, sir?
I am doing great. I've been looking forward to this, and I've been doing research, and I'll tell you, Richard, we could do three programs. So much has happened in last 3 days. It is amazing. So, first of all, tell us about the 9th District in North Carolina, why there are so many candidates running for this office and why it's so important.
Well, Sue Myrick, who held the office for 9 terms and ran on the ticket, ran on the promise that she was only going to be in office for 2 terms, has finally decided that it is time to step down. So there is no incumbent that we're running against in this district, and there's been a lot of people who have thrown their hat into the ring for this seat. The problem I have is I am tired. I mean, when I say tired, I mean I'm really tired from the burden of knowing that our current election process is does not give us the best candidates for the job. And I'm looking at right here in the 9th District, where we have 11 candidates running in this Republican primary. But the amazing thing about, just to give you an idea of how the election process works in the good old boy network, we have the outgoing Congresswoman, Sue Myrick, who has already endorsed one of her fellow Republicans, endorsed them without even, she's never talked to me, and I don't know if she's talked to the other candidates. There's a problem there. How do you go out and endorse someone when you haven't even interviewed the other candidate? There's a problem there. Would you agree with that or not?
Oh, I totally agree. I mean, it sounds like cronyism. It sounds like, well, I'm going to step down because I've run four times as many terms as I said I was going to run, and I'm going to go ahead and endorse this guy to replace me. Well, that's just shoehorning another crony right into place. You know, there are 10 other candidates beside this person that she's trying to endorse, but she has already given an unfair advantage for this candidate over the other candidates by using the power of her office, which I assume she's still going to be in office until November, to this
right.
other candidate.
And this is the problem. You know, I am the only candidate right now of the 11 candidates who will tell you that the other candidates are going to tell you that there is a problem in Washington and we need to fix it. Well, that's sort of like taking your car to a mechanic and you say to the mechanic, our car is going ka-kunk, 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 and it's not running right. And you give it to the mechanic and he comes back to you 5 hours later and he says, Brooks, you know, your car is going ka-kunk, 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 and it's not running right. He hasn't told you what's causing the problem or how to fix it. And that's what's happening right now. We have a lot of these candidates out there, not only in this race, but in the presidential race and other congressional races across the country. They're all talking about, oh, there's a problem in Washington. We've got to fix it. I am the only candidate that's saying that what's causing the problem. Now let's talk about that for 1 second, because that's very important, and this will bring go. This will be a good segue into to go. A little bit about my background. I ran for governor of New Jersey in 1993, and one of my campaign slogans was, "We for far too long have experienced government that only throws money at problems with never evaluating what's causing the problem." And here we are in this country where the electorate is out there, and they're saying, we are going to send the same people to Washington to correct the problems that those people in Washington are creating.
Well, I like the one, Richard, where the people say, we have a real problem here. Something's out of control. And the elected official says, I am appointing a task force. And
yes.
We're going to study the problem.
Yeah, super committee.
Super committee, right. That's when you know they don't have a clue. Or when they use the word comprehensive, that's when they don't have a clue.
What's that?
When they use the word comprehensive. We're gonna take a comprehensive look
yes.
at this. You see, Richard and I have similar
backgrounds. I tell people that one of the getting back to the cause of the problem, here's what's causing the problem in this country. We can't blame the politicians. We can partly blame ourselves, because what we have done is, over the years, we have allowed the two parties to take control of the entire election process, where that election process does not render the best candidates for the job, but instead renders the best candidates to perpetuate the party's policies, programs, and agenda. So until we're willing to say, you know what? We've got to address the election process. We've got to find a way to send better qualified people or better constitutionally minded people to Washington. Because what we're faced with right now, let's face it, we are faced with what I like to call the constitutionally challenged in Washington. They don't have a clue. I don't even think they could spell Constitution, let alone have they ever read it. And we're getting the same. Why is it? Let me ask you, where else can you go in this world, do your job right 5% of the time, and get reemployed 95% of the time?
And get a raise and one great pension plan.
And vote the raise yourself.
Yeah.
So
I hear you
comes
talking.
Into the process, and let me give you a little bit of background on Go. Go was a brainstorm of a gentleman who was actually on his way home from work one night. The founder of Go is Tim Cox. And Tim Cox was very instrumental in the development and the design of the computer programs that brought us pay at the pump. So every time you go to a gas station and you swipe that credit card, think of Tim Cox. He is the one who was very much responsible for those fine devices in our life. He's also the founder of Go. He's on his way home one night, and he hears back then where the approval rating was as high as 18%, and he heard where, you know, Congress has an 18% approval rating, yet they're reelected 95% of the time. And it dawned on me, how is that possible? Now, you've probably never met Tim Cox. I have, and he is as about as mild-mannered as they come. I don't think his blood pressure ever gets over 110. He's very soft-spoken. He's a real gentleman. And he said he actually got upset when he heard that. And he went home, and he was so upset, and he kind of went into like a little bit of a rant. His son says to him, well, Dad, you're a problem solver. Figure out a way to fix it. And it was a challenge to him. And there was a series of events that took place in his life over the next few years that kind of led him into this direction that he had to do something. Now, the irony is that while he was working on his plan called the GO, which stands for Get Out of Our House, which was a plan to replace the representatives in the House with actual constituent representation, I happened to be working on a plan where I was looking to basically infiltrate the Republican Party with some very constitutionally conservative-minded individuals and say to the Republican Party, look, either you get your act together or, you know, we will form a third party. And I had this whole elaborate plan laid out, and I'd heard about Tim Cox and what he was doing, and I actually went to listen to Tim Cox to change his mind and try to get him to come over to my site and help me with my plan. Well, when I went to his presentation, I was so blown away by what he was proposing and what his concept was, I walked out of that meeting as a foot soldier for Go. And to this day, and it's been 3 years now, everyone and anyone who will listen to me, I tell them about the Go process. And the thing is, Brooks, is it's so simple that people can't grasp that something as simple as Go would work. It's
well,
sort of
simplicity,
like the fair tax. People can't grasp something as simple as a fair tax, which abolishes all the burdensome regulations and tax records and everything else that goes along with it. They can't grasp that because they've been indoctrinated over the years to accept that you've got to do this every April 15th. Sit down and do all this paperwork, and you've got to keep all your records. Well, Tim Cox came up with a way that was so simple to get true representation within the district that people, when you tell them about it and how it works, it's like, wow, really? So having said that, let me tell you how it works. Very simple. Basically, what you do is before the election, like we just went through our election process here, you hold meetings in your district, and you get these groups of people together, and you break them up into groups of 10. let's say there's 200 at a meeting one night, and you break them up into groups of 10, and they go through a series of questions and debate, and you have a chance to do your own stump speech, and it's one-on-one, and then it's one, you address the group, and at the end of this session, you vote, and everybody votes for their favorite candidate. They start off, I left that apart there, they start off in the beginning of the session voting for who their favorite candidate would be. This is before they really get to know them, only after they've made a small introduction. And then at the end of the meeting, you vote for your number one candidate. And the two people in that group that receive the most votes, they proceed to the next round. Sort of like basketball. You win in this group, then you go to the next round. And you do this until you come down to one final group of 10 in your district. And then they come up with that final group of 10 with one candidate. And that candidate, you can be a Republican, a Democrat, a Libertarian. You can be of any party affiliation. It doesn't matter. What GO does is it removes a lot of the going out and trying to raise campaign funds and taking special interest money, and you sign a contract with GO that says you will abide by the very thing that you committed yourself to in a written questionnaire when you ran for office. So you filled out a job interview, and in that job interview, you answered questions a certain way, things that you would do. And if you go to Congress and you try to do something different, you will be removed immediately because you signed a contract that says that if you don't abide by what you said you would do, you will be removed immediately. And in addition to that, you sign a contract that says you will only run for 2 terms.
Well, the House of Representatives, the Congress, is an analog of the House of Commons in Great Britain. When the Founding Fathers put our government together, they broke the government up into sections that were very similar to governments that they came from. But they realized that the president was going to be very much like the monarch. And so they placed a balance between the three branches, legislative, judicial, and executive. The legislative branch is made of two groups, the House of Commons and the House of Lords, the Congress and the Senate. Now, when it was originally set up, congressmen were elected from the common people, like a businessman, a bus driver, a school teacher, a policeman, an engineer, a plant manager, would go to Washington and represent his district for 2 years and then come home, and someone else would go. The Senate was appointed by the state legislators, and that's so that that person could be tied directly to local politics on the state level. If the state didn't like what that senator was doing in Washington, they could take action right at their state legislators and very local guys that, you know, that they live right down the street from them, and they could take action that way. Then the 17th Amendment was passed, and senators were allowed to run for election. Now, the problem has become that we have senators that have been serving for over 30 years. 30 years since the Vietnam War they've been serving. Now, the strange thing about this is that they don't pull campaign funds from their own district. They pull campaign funds from a national pool of money that comes in. Even international money comes in and supports senators. The Senate has been the foot draggers for the last 20 years. It has really, really been incredible how little action we have seen out of the legislative branch, almost always because the Senate is the one that won't take the action, whether it's impeachment, whether it's articles of tariff or protection or whatever. It's the Senate that usually sticks it in the mud. So, and by the way, you talk about simplicity, Rich.
Would you not agree that what you just said aside, I think the biggest problem facing the American people today is the total lack of our Congress, House and Senate, their total lack of abiding by, supporting, defending, upholding the U.S. Constitution. You know, a representative, and the form that, the way I understand it, our government was formed, is he goes to Congress, and there are certain ideas that might be thrown out, you know, like we're going to build a national railroad. So everybody says, okay. So now that representative goes back to his district, and he says, hey, they want to build a railroad. The federal government wants to build a railroad. What do you think? And he gets the pulse of his constituents. He gets to understand they're for it or they're against it. Then he's supposed to go back to Washington and say, you know what, my people don't think this is a good idea. Now you got 435 representatives doing that. And they take a vote on it based on what the feedback was they got from their citizens. And if it's more people that want it than not, then that's representative form of government. We don't have that today. We have representatives that go to Washington without ever coming back to their districts with what's being proposed because there's 10,000 pages of regulations being written a month, 10,000 pages a month. They don't come back to the district.
Well, let me just put a point of clarification in here.
Look what they do in Texas.
Richard.
Their legislature meets once every 2 years.
I understand that.
They go home.
Let me put in a point of clarification here. The Congress writes bills which are passed and become law. Regulations are something completely different. They're generated by the agencies, departments, and bureaus that work for the president. That 10,000 pages a month that's written, those regulations have the force of law, but there's no representation of the people in writing those regulations. Congress doesn't hear about those regulations until they affect some of their constituents, who then come to the congressperson and say, hey, this regulation is really harsh on my gig here. And the congressman says, I didn't even know about that regulation. Let's go complain to the agency. Well, I just went through this last week, and I can tell you right now that the regulations, the agencies have laws in place. You're not going to believe this, but I'm raising my right hand to you here. This is the absolute truth. The agencies have laws in place that make it illegal for them to discuss any specific case with Congress. And there are stiff penalties that go against.
How did we ever relinquish the power of our Congress to agencies? How did we ever do that?
Well, on March 16th, just two days ago.
Is that these agencies control the Congress instead of the other way around.
You are exactly right. Exactly correct. March 16th, today's the 18th, March 16th, just 2 days ago, the president signed an executive order called the National Defense Resources Preparedness Act, and it modifies the Defense Production Act of 1950, and it empowers 17 different secretaries to do one thing, advise the president on issues of national defense resource planning. And let's see, hang on a second. Let me get down to this big shall. There's a big shall right down here. Here we go. This is what the agency or what the President's Act does. They shall be prepared in the event of a potential threat to the security of the United States to take actions necessary to ensure the availability of adequate resources and production capability, including services and critical technology for national defense. And they are empowered to use wage and price controls, which means this is how President Obama will seize controls of the price of gas. He's doing it by executive order.
Well, let me ask you a question. If my understanding of the Constitution is correct, and I believe it is, that it is the supreme law of the land, and if there are certain powers that are strictly within the Congress's ability, then the assumption of power by the president and anything that he institutes along with that assumption cannot be, you cannot be bound by it. I mean, the U.S. Supreme Court, if I understand correctly, has ruled that anything that is not within the constitutional boundaries is to be deemed null and void. If it's not, that, I think one of the biggest problems, this is the way I see it, one of the biggest problems we have is how we give validity to something that should have no validity. And if I went out tomorrow and I said, I have the right to use your car whenever I want to, and you don't challenge me, and I just start using your car whenever I want to, and then eventually it's just accepted practice that I'm always going to be able to use that car, it becomes much harder to correct it after it's been instituted, but it was wrong nonetheless. So this assumption of power by the president through executive orders is an assumption of power. We've got to correct that. And the only way you're going to correct that is to get back to constitutional government, which clearly defines what the power of the president, the Senate, the House, and the judiciary is. And until we get back to that, all the problems that you're seeing, not only with executive orders, but with regulations, which are created as a direct result of bad legislation, that's not going to get fixed. We've got to get back to constitutional government. And the other thing, I am the only candidate running in the 9th District. In fact, I'm the only candidate I've heard anywhere who actually has a 5-step plan for getting back to constitutional government. And it's very simple. It's one that the average citizen, anybody could understand. Number one, I believe that all bills introduced must be accompanied by, first, a statement of their constitutional foundation. And if you can't find in the Constitution with the foundation for what you're introducing, it doesn't get introduced, period. Why discuss it if it's not in the Constitution? Because if I understand it correctly, as a representative, that Constitution, for all intents and purposes, that's my working contract. That's my contract that I agreed to when you, the people of my district, hire me to send me to Washington.
Yeah, that's the operating agreement.
Am I wrong in that?
No, that's the operating agreement. You're exactly right. And for a long time, that's exactly what the Supreme Court did. And oftentimes, the federal government overreached its bounds, especially when these cases, you know, make their way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court ruled against the federal government on several cases. Most of them, you know, had to do with labor and commerce and things like that in years coming up. But I will say that in the last 30 years, we have seen what Roosevelt originally set up, where the Constitution allowed the president to have a cabinet, which are advisors, experts in certain fields that agree with him, that are able to advise him in things like engineering and economics and, you know, foreign policy, because he's not an expert in everything. So he's allowed to have experts right to advise him. But what has happened is these advisors have now become secretaries. And these advisors now run departments, bureaus, agencies, and so forth, and they consume about 50% of the taxpayer money that the government takes in. We get no accounting on those budgets. I just read the Homeland Security Act budget, and I put a lot of it into my new book, Alienated Nation. And it's an $89 billion budget for 2012. And over 80% of it, 81% of it, is discretionary. It means they can spend it anywhere they want. Nobody knows where this money is going. It's done by the agency. Now, Richard's exactly right. There's no constitutional basis for this agency to even exist, especially in peacetime. So the executive branch claims that we are at war all the time, even though Congress has not declared war. And so it's kind of a loosey-goosey basis for all of this. Now, you made the statement that, You know, this gets very, very simple. I had a proctor when I was in grad school that said simplicity was the crown of genius. Complexity was the cloak of mediocrity. Well, if there is anyone out there listening tonight that believes we have a simple tax code, you need to get a clue. We have the most complex tax code you could possibly imagine, and it is the cloak of mediocrity, to be sure. Let me remind you our phone number anywhere in North America, 888-429-5471. Richard will answer questions, and I will too. I have some things that I wrote down as questions. I want to get into the other four things. You said the first one was a constitutional sort of litmus test. Does it have a constitutional
That's
foundation?
Right.
And if it doesn't, then we're not gonna have it. Normally, I would take a break right here for about 4 minutes, but we're on a roll. It's my program, and so I'm opting not to have a break. So hang with us, people. Here's the first question before we get into your four things. Explain to us what the fair tax is. There's a lot of confusing information about there. This tax, that tax, a flat tax, a this tax. What's a fair tax?
Another way of looking at the fair tax is the consumption tax. It's when you buy anything new, there's a tax that is put on that new item. And it replaces the income tax, corporate tax, death tax, inheritance tax, capital gains tax. It abolishes the IRS. So April 15th is just basically another beautiful spring day. The beautiful thing about the fair tax, and I mean, I could speak on the fair tax for hours on end, because when you look at where we are today in terms of the requirement to comply with the current income tax system, when did America ever lose its guts, its strength to relinquish to this federal government the ability for them to demand of you that you keep track of everything you do all year long in your life? When did we ever do that?
That would be
now. There are those out there.
The 16th
some studying and research and say, oh, wait a minute, we've never done that. Do your homework. That's a whole other issue. But assuming we did, when did we ever say it was okay for them to come into our lives and demand that we keep track of everything we do, and more importantly, to then take our money, give it to them to spend amongst people who give no money, to buy their vote, to keep them in power, to keep us enslaved, and the system goes on? There's something inherently wrong with that. There's something wrong with saying that I'm going to take from those who produce, use that money to buy the votes of those who don't produce, so that I can stay in power to continue raising the taxes on those who do produce.
Well,
the
I call it.
Go ahead.
I call it the age of the professional voter. Franklin once said, "It is the death of any republic when the public can vote for itself a piece of the treasury." Well, that's exactly what we have. We have legislators who are selling the treasury to the public for votes. They're buying votes by laundering taxpayer money back to those voters. Real quick, Richard, we do have a caller from California. Chris, you're online too. Welcome to the program.
Wow, what an incredible program it is. Thanks so much for such important issues, Brooks.
I appreciate it. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. My question is a little off topic. I was kind of curious if there's any updates about the hollow earth, inner earth.
Chris, come on. Try to stick with the program here. the expedition, we are talking to a producer, a production company now, about doing the film, the documentary from this scientific expedition. And it is really a hollow earth expedition. It's a trip above the Arctic Circle to do an exploration of an ancient legend that there may be an opening into the earth up there. No one's ever gone to see. So that's the only update that I have. I'll have more on a subsequent program, but I'm just trying to stick with the topic here. I have a congressional candidate on the radio tonight, and I don't want to talk about science right now. Is that okay?
Oh, I understand. I'm enjoying the program, too. I wish much luck to the candidate, and I'm enjoying the show.
Hey, Chris, give me a feel for the state of California. How is California feeling about this GO movement and the fair tax?
As there obviously, you know, isn't too much public awareness that I've noticed from the streets. I kind of work in a military surplus store, though, so I'm getting a little bit more demand for, you know, just all-around preparedness. But as far as what's going on politically, if anything, it's a saddening kind of favor for Obama and kind of this general greening, you know, agenda. And I remember you saying, too, in a kind of a previous podcast about how much of California is pretty high, and that's, you know, a lot of that influence going on as well.
I understand. I appreciate your perspective, my friend, and thank you so much for the call.
Hey, thanks so much for the show, Brooks. Much luck. Take care.
All right, thanks. So the fair tax is basically just what the states do. They have a sales tax. So when you buy a pair of shoes or a TV or something at a department store, they throw the state tax on there. Nobody gives a second thought about it because states have to run their business, and that's how they do their money. And that's like some states like Tennessee and Florida and Texas, that's the only tax they have. They don't have an income tax. And yet those states continuously run balanced budgets. They have great roads. They have all the municipal services that any other state would have, and you don't have to waive your Fifth Amendment rights to self-incrimination by filling out some form that says, this is how much I made, really. But that's what we do every day, every year on April 15th. So what's wrong with this picture, Richard? Why is it so hard for the federal government to do exactly what the states have been doing forever?
I think if you look at the origination of income tax, and not just income tax, there is one descriptive word that goes before income, and it's called progressive. And I'm sure I don't have to tell you this, but the term progressive income tax is right out of the Communist Manifesto. It was an idea born by Karl Marx. And the reason there was to be a progressive income tax as opposed to just a flat tax on everybody paying the same thing was under his little model, he didn't want anybody to ever gain power through wealth. So the more you made, the more they took. So that's why it was progressive. Now, are you there?
Yeah, I just was laughing at that because the more you make, the more they're going to take. It's like, no, wait. See, your pie, your slice of the pie is already too big. So government's going to take more money since you're earning more.
Well, here's a little scenario I like to use. When I was running for governor of New Jersey, and I got into a debate with a gentleman one night about paying your fair share. And I've used this many times, and I've yet to find anybody who has an answer to it. I said, I want you to define fair share. I said, but before you do, I want to give you a little example here. Suppose you lived in a neighborhood, and in this neighborhood you had, in one part of the neighborhood, you had a doctor who was, he was making $500,000 a year, and let's just say, for argument's sake, he was paying $150,000 in taxes. Now, here's a doctor who's gone through 8 years of med school. He went out. He borrowed $400,000 to get himself through school, and he's paying these $150,000 in taxes, and there's a good chance that he doesn't use the police department or any of the city facilities because he's got private trash collection, private security, the whole nine yards, and he's not really using any of the community services, so to speak. Now, down the street from him, you've got, we're going to say, a carpenter. And he works his 40 hours a week, and he's maybe making $45,000 a year, paying maybe $15,000 in taxes. And he spends his weekend, he sits on his porch and talks with his neighbors, has a couple beers and relaxes and what have you, and there's nothing wrong with that. But down the street from him, you get the guy who's a loser. He's never worked a day in his life. The only thing he's ever been able to do is game the system. He gets free food, free clothing, free health care, free everything, free shelter, and puts not one penny into the system, even though he's quite capable. Explain fair share. How? Where's the fair share? There's three individuals. They're all human beings. They've all done different things with their lives. Where's the fair share? Why is the doctor paying $150,000? Why is the carpenter paying $15,000? And the guy that pays nothing is receiving everything. Why is that? How's that? Where's the fair share? And there is no explanation, because under the current income tax system, there is nothing fair about it at all. Under the current income tax system, the more you make, the more they take. So where's the incentive to do well? You get to the point where eventually you say, wait a minute. I mean, I have seen it firsthand. I have actually seen people reach a point in their life where they realize that their neighbor, and I witnessed this firsthand. A friend of mine was working. He was a welder, and he'd come home every night, and he realized that the guy that lived across the street from him, he says, you know, I come home at night and he's got a steak on the grill. Next time I come home, he's, you know, he's out there, he's cooking fish or this. This guy hasn't worked in months, and he's driving a good car. His house is as nice as mine, and he's got just about everything I have, and he's not working at all. Why am I working? So when you get to the point that eventually we will get to, and I'm sure you've probably read Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged, where eventually the givers, the producers, the intellectual community just finally bow out of the system and they say, here, you know, it's up to you takers now. When you get to the point where you don't have enough takers or enough givers to supply the takers, and it's all takers, what do you do? As Margaret Thatcher said, you know, socialism is a great idea until you run out of somebody else's mind.
Well, yeah, you're exactly right. So let's talk about that. So we're talking about a fair tax as opposed to a progressive income tax. Of course, the two ideological differences are, with the fair tax, you don't have to report to me how much you're making. You can earn as much as you want, from interest, from work, from mowing grass, from painting houses, doing nails, cutting hair, investing in stocks. Make as much money as you want. But when you spend it, you're going to pay the tax. The other is, you can make as much money as you want, but you're going to tell us about it. And then, depending upon how the government feels about the way that you earned your money, whether it's from dividends or wages or capital gains or selling real estate or an inheritance, we're going to tax it differently because we have a different judgment on that style of enriching yourself. Who can make heads or tails of it? I just spent 3 hours at H&R Block doing my taxes on Saturday of this week, and I don't have that complicated of a business. I'm just an engineering consultant. I can imagine somebody that's running a small business that has goods and services and employees and cost of goods sold and capital improvements that they make to their facility. I could see you'd probably have to hire a professional to do those taxes. And then I can also see that the IRS probably has to have about 275,000 people working for them in order to go through all these voluminous returns that are sent in just to see if they're legal, if they're accurate, if they make sense. And all that is overhead on the system. How much overhead is there to run the fair tax system?
Minimal. And when I say minimal, you're talking about basically an administration that would probably be a tenth of what it is now, but more importantly, the cost to the taxpayer in terms of compliance costs would go down to zero.
Oh, you mean
and
I don't?
Here is a number that will absolutely boggle your mind. It is estimated, and I'm going to go to on the low side and the high side. By some economists, it's $500 billion. By other economists, it's $900 billion. $900 billion, $900 billion in compliance costs to comply with the current IRS tax code.
Now, that's not really generating revenue.
No, it doesn't even generate revenue. That is more, if you were to break that down into man hours, it's more man hours than is employed in the auto industry, the aircraft industry, the computer industry, and the radio talk show host industry combined. Combined. It's like if you were to take, and I believe the number is 27,000 people, and put them in a room, and all they did for 40 hours a week was do nothing but fill out tax papers, and you produced no wealth, you just fill those papers out. That's how much labor we're wasting.
Well, let me ask you a question. It's obvious that this... Let me just ask you a question. This is obviously a labor boondoggle, costing almost $1 trillion a year in non-productive work just to stay compliant with this voluminous tax code. Why, let me, straight up, do you think the majority of the American people would support a fair tax? And if not, why not?
Well, I think that if they are fed the erroneous information that is being passed about by the opponents of the fair tax, they would not support it. But if they were fed the fact, if they were actually given the fact that, you know, the fair tax, and this is the part that's mind-boggling. When the fair tax is instituted, within 24 to 30 months, it's almost going to be as if you're not paying any tax at all, and I'll show you how that works. Right now, every product that you buy, whether it's a loaf of bread, a cup of coffee at your corner store, an automobile, anything you buy has what's called embedded tax in it. And what that embedded tax is that's the tax that whoever built that car, they paid employees' taxes, the employees paid the taxes, the people that made the metal paid taxes, everything that touched that car was taxed, and it's embedded in the price of the commodity that you buy. And by some estimate, that cost is anywhere between 20 to 23% of the value that you pay on that for that car. So just imagine, let's just say it's a coat, and you go out and buy a coat, and it's $100. $23 of that is embedded cost, and that's taxes. And I love to use this example. You buy a loaf of bread. And you look at a loaf of bread and you figure, okay, there's bread in there and there's a plastic bag. Well, no. Somebody had to grow the wheat, and that person that grew the wheat had to buy the seed. So it starts with the seed, starts with the farmer who grew the wheat. It goes to the refiner. He refined that wheat into flour. Then it goes from the flour to a company that makes the bread. Then that company buys those plastic bags. The people who make those plastic bags have to buy the components to go in those plastic bags, even down to that little twisty that goes on the end of the bag. And all this stuff has to be taken to the stores. And everything that you use to take that to the stores, the trucks, the whatever, they have vehicles, and those vehicles all have to be built, and they have tires on them, and it goes on and on and on and on, and you begin to realize that something as simple as a loaf of bread that might cost you $2, if you could remove all the taxes it took to get that loaf of bread just to the shelf, you'd probably take 45 cents out of a loaf of bread.
So on the wholesale side, there would be no tax in the system. It would only be at the retail level. When I go to the store and I buy the loaf of bread, a fixed amount of that cost, let's just say it's 15%, just for numbers off the top of my head. 15%.
Well, I'll give you the actual number. Right now it's proposed at 23%.
All right, 23%. Now, that sounds high, people. It does. It sounds high. But, and I could see the naysayers out there saying this is really going to hurt the poor, because the poor don't pay any tax at all, and they're not going to be able to afford a 23% hike in the price of goods out there that they're trying to buy. But that's not actually what will happen. The price of those products will not go up.
it'll actually go down because of this embedded tax being removed.
And then it's replaced with this consumption tax. But in terms of the poor, and this is a part of the fair tax that a lot of people understand, there will be built into this system a prebate. And the prebate is you will get a check every month based on the level of poverty that will pay for the taxes that you would be paying on food, shelter, and clothing. So the poor will automatically get a check. The rich will get a check. Everybody will get this check that will pay for the taxes that they would be spending on the necessities of life.
Why not just not tax those items? Just don't tax them. Like a lot of states tax
because
food.
Because then you open up Pandora's box. And they don't want to do that. They want it as plain and as simple as you can get. If you buy a new item, it's going to get taxed. Period. One of the problems that we have right now, Brooke, is that you take any program that the government's involved with, and I was using this example the other day. Let's talk about the no smoking laws they have today. The no smoking laws actually started as a ban on smoking in federal buildings in Washington, D.C.
I remember
that. That's how I got started. And now we're at the point where, and I'm not a smoker, so you know I'm not out there advocating smoking or anything like that. I'm just trying to give you an example of how once that camel gets its nose in your tent, forget it. You got the camel in the tent. And that's what happens with government. So with the fair tax, we're not going to let the camel get its nose in the tent by saying, okay, we'll exclude these items. Because then they build off that. And then you end up with where we are today with this long list of favored items and unfavored items, and then you got lobbyists and they're trying to get their items in, and then you get back to the complexities of what is and what isn't. No, just tax it across the board, make a provision for rebating, we call it a prebate, for those items of necessity. Is it perfect? No. But is it better than what we currently have? By far. Does it remove the power that the politicians in Washington currently have over businesses and individuals? You better believe it. Is that one of the main reasons why it's being fought so hard in Washington? You better believe it. Because the other thing, right now, when you know the story of withholding tax, I'm sure, that was a little deceitful tactic that they used so that you really didn't realize how much you were paying in taxes. My daughter works for, to give you an idea how great they are at covering things, my daughter works for a payroll service. And you would be surprised how many people do not know how much they make. They can tell you what they take home, but they don't know what they make.
Right.
They are actually brainwashed into believing that's what they make after the taxes have been taken out.
Well, in order for the fair tax to pass, it's sort of like voting in term limits on congressmen, which I don't think we should do offhand. Although I don't see what it would hurt to make it four terms and you're out or whatever, just like we do on the president, would prevent these dynasties from being formed. What could it hurt? It's not going to hurt anything to do that. But I don't think a fair tax is going to be passed unless we make sweeping changes in who is occupying those offices in Washington. So this is why Get Out of Our House movement was formed. That's why there's a movement to remove the existing members of Congress. How many states is Go operating in? And are there success stories yet, besides yours, that we have to relate to the people that are listening to the program tonight and who will listen tomorrow and the next day and the next day on the archives. Are there any success stories from Go, and is it building momentum? How is it being received by the people?
It is not only are there our current candidates right now. We have candidates in Texas, Georgia, Florida, North Carolina, I believe Maryland. If you go to the website, GOOOH.com, you can research where all the candidates are running right now through the GO process. And it's funny you ask, how is it being received? Once it is explained, and as I said earlier in the show, when I went to hear Tim Cox give his presentation and actually went there to change his mind and walked away as a foot soldier, I get it all the time. When I talk to people about the simplicity of Go, one of the first things they want to know is, well, how come we're not doing that? And, you know, you explain to them. It's just like I consider Go the revolution of 2012. Like we had the revolution, you know, the declaring of our independence. This is the declaring of our, we're going to take back our election process in this country. We're going to take back control of how we elect our officials. We're going to find, we're going to use this system to send people into Washington who are not constitutionally challenged to understand what representative government is. And the Go process, when people, once they go to that website and once they get to understand exactly how it works and the simplicity of it and that they can be involved with, you know, right now, I've never been involved in a process where, you know, I went out and hand-selected these Republican candidates. I was always told these are the Republican candidates you're going to vote for.
Yeah, I
get the same thing. These are the Democrat candidates you're going to vote for. Where did they come from? Well, they work up through the ranks. Well, I don't want somebody to work. Yeah, I tell people, America does not need experienced politicians. We need people who have experienced the hardships created by these constitutionally challenged politicians.
I was talking to Sean Hannity one day. He was on the radio and he was talking about the Republican primary process. This was a few months back. And I called in and said to the screener that Sean was what was wrong with America. Of course, that got me on the radio right away. And I told Sean, you are what's wrong with the Republican Party today. He said, how so? I said, because you guys that are de facto spokespeople for the Republican Party pick the candidate with the best hair, the biggest bank account, the tallest guy. You say, this is the guy that looks presidential, and that's the guy you get behind. You don't get behind a guy who's maybe small of stature. He might wear a sweater to a debate, but he's got the best ideas. You don't get behind ideas. You get behind who looks good on camera, who's presidential, who performs well under the showboat of a debate in front of the people, which is really an unscripted, let's see how you react to this kind of day. That's not anything what being a leader in Congress or in the executive branch is like. And that's what's wrong with the Republican Party. I said, you guys need to take a lesson from the Democrats. They can take a community organizer that nobody has ever heard of, and even if they did hear of him, they'd be leery of his name, and they can make him president in 2 years. They can bring him from the sidewalk to the White House in 2 years, and you can't. That's because you don't do it right.
I like that. That's very powerful. And I tell you what, you make a very good point. But unfortunately, what the Republicans and the Democrats do very well, one party a little bit better than the other, I guess, but what they do very well is they control the entire election process. That is, it doesn't matter if you're Republican or Democrat, you're part of the problem. you guys are the ones out there that are destroying this country, because we've got a population of over 300 million people. Now, I defy anybody to tell me out of 300 million people, we end up with a Nancy Pelosi, a Harry Reid, a John Boehner to be on the Republican side. These people that go into Washington and make these statements that are just so out and left. Somebody sent me a video the other day of a representative from Georgia. His name was Jackson. I can't remember. Alan, I forget his first name. But he is a representative from Georgia, Democrat. And he was actually, this was during some hearing where he is questioning a general about the population of Guam. Have you seen that video?
No, I haven't.
Well, I'm telling you, you've got to go Google Jackson, Representative Georgia, Guam interview. And in this testimony, or in this hearing, he tells this general that his concern is that if we get too many people on the island of Guam with our armed forces there, that, and he actually demonstrates, he says, that the island will tip over. Now, this is the type of people we have in Washington.
I believe you. I go to Washington from time to time, and I am amazed. The last time I was there, I went with 400 businessmen from this state, and the Democratic National Committee chairman, Wasserman, she comes to the mic as she made her speech. And this wasn't a Republican event. This was the Congressional National Business Summit, okay? She finished speaking, and nothing. No applause, nothing. No standing, no movement, no sound. There might as well have been no one in that audience. And she left. And then Nancy Pelosi came out and she spoke and she gave a real rah-rah speech. Nothing. Nobody moved. Nobody said a word and nobody clapped. And then Reese Priebus, the Republican National Committee chairman, come out and he got three standing ovations and the place was just pounding it out. Not because of who he was, because of what he was saying. He was saying that the regulations in Washington are out of control. We need some help, and it's all about jobs, jobs, jobs. That is not what we were hearing from the Democrats. Now, that being said, this is all political, you know, burgers and fries. They're just feeding us what we're hungry to hear. Go is doing something different. What they appear to be doing is bringing common sense candidates who are natural problem solvers, who will represent, or skilled problem solvers, who will represent their constituents to Washington. That's what it was designed to be in the first place. Now, if we can throw out 80% or 90% of the 435 congressmen that we have, it's going to be very, very difficult for the lobbyists to jump back in there and reestablish their ironclad network that they have right now, gaining control of all the major committees. These committees will have to be reformed all over again with brand new people. Are we really going to miss a beat? Are we going to miss a step as a nation if we do this?
Well, I think the most important product, the most important result that will come out of the GO process once we have gained a stronghold, and we will gain a stronghold in the election process and make way for more of the constituents being involved with the election process and who they're sending to Washington. But the greatest product that's going to come out of that is hopefully we will get a Congress that understands the importance of preserving America's future, because as it is right now, we have a Congress that, well, we have an entire Washington elite that are spending our future generations into debt at such an alarming rate. I mean, my grandkids were here last night, two of my grandkids. I had six grandkids. And the two that were here last night, one is five, one's eight. And I read somewhere, I guess it was maybe 5 or 6 months ago, somebody sent me an email that projected if you were 6 years old now, and by the time you were 18 entering the workforce, at the current rate of expenditure, we will have to tax you at 95% of your income in order for us to pay down our national debt. Now think about that for a second. We're basically saying that we are going to, if we don't change things, we're going to be willing to sit back and know that our children, our grandchildren, are actually going to end up being slaves, because there's no other way to describe it when you're working for 5 cents on a dollar, because we didn't take action today. And if you can live with that on your conscience, then I have no room for you in my life.
Well, I mean, you hear the Democrat pundits, and they'll say things like, look, 65% of the budget is already set. There's nothing the president can do about it. Right? It's all in automatic. There is no control he has over that part of the budget, and it's entitlements. That's absolutely not true. We're not talking about Social Security. We're not talking about Medicaid. That's not 65% of the budget. What we're talking about here are the bureaus, departments, and agencies. There are 17 of them that consume 65% of the cash that you all send to Washington, and they produce nothing, with the exception of the Department of Defense. They actually do something to defend the country. But the Department of Energy, the Department of Commerce, Interior, Education, Health and Human Services, are you crazy? That is a lot of money that we are spending on those departments, agencies, and bureaus, and we're getting nothing in return. Nothing. And each agency has a set of laws that makes it illegal for them to speak to Congress. It makes it illegal for them to speak to Congress. We have no representation. The system is broke.
Well, let me ask you a question. Unless I am mistaken, expenditures start in the House, do they not? Congress can spend money, right?
Well, it's supposed to be only Congress spends money, but the agency...
No, I'm saying, my question is, according to the Constitution, if I'm correct, as it is written right now, has not been amended, now correct me if I'm wrong, as it is written right now, Congress is the one that appropriates money. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Don't you think it's a little disingenuous when you have the representatives and the senators out there talking about the president spending this and the president spending that and doing this and doing that, when in fact all we have to do is exercise the constitutional authority to not give them any money?
But that's not what happens. What happens is he orders his secretaries, who then pass those orders into the agencies, and they pass a regulation requiring a fee or requiring an enforcement action or a tax or a fine. And that is how they raise their money, and they can apply money anywhere they want to.
I'm talking about the federal budget right now, the money that is spent by Congress, money that is appropriated by Congress coming in through the taxpayers. That money, if they wanted to, they don't have to put out one penny to any agency they don't want to. Furthermore, if you were in your house, if you were trying to cut back in your budget, wouldn't you start with the small things first, try to cut back on those? Mike, I don't understand. Here's one thing I would love for somebody to give me a good sound answer to this. We have a Congress that is always talking about Obama spending and the debt going up up over under Obama's administration, and yet they have set back, as he has compiled, I think it's, correct me if I'm wrong, 34 czars right now. His wife has a personal staff of 22, and they jet all over the world on a regular basis. My question is, when? Why can't we start with the little things and say, no more of that? Get rid of the czars. Get rid of these extra expenditures. Let's start somewhere. Let's send a message to the American people that we're serious about reining in the size and scope of government.
Yeah, you're exactly right. You open a whole nother subject beside the 17 agencies I talked about. You're exactly right. We have 34 czars, one of whom was Stephen Gatner, who is the guy that that dissolved and reorganized General Motors and Chrysler. He's the guy that closed 789 Chrysler dealerships. 788 of them were Republican contributors. And rearranged all that, and then he was convicted of securities fraud and sentenced to pay $26 million in fines, and then he was forbidden from trading. They wanted to do 10 years, but they forbid him from trading for 2 years. This was Obama's czar. This is the quality of individual that Obama is picking as a czar and making things making these decisions happen in the private sector. And by the way, all of that.
This is the quality of people that our Congress is giving the president the money to pay for.
You're right.
They don't have to pay for that. Say no. It has. When I go to Washington, one of the first things I'm going to do is anytime appropriations come down for anything like that, I'm going to say no. Absolutely not. Those are our money. No staff of 23 for your wife. No $2 or $3 million trip to Spain. No. Now let's get down to the really important stuff. No Department of Health and Human Services. No Department of Education. None of the departments that are not constitutional. Let's start somewhere. And right now, the only thing we have in Washington is a bunch of weenies who, are constitutionally challenged. They go along to get along. And I tell you right now, Brooks, I cannot believe that in a state, in a country of over 300 million people, we can't find a better. I bet you could go to the phone book and stick out the first 435 people that you stuck your name, your finger on the phone book could probably do a better job than what we got going on in Washington right now.
I couldn't agree more. I could not agree more. Now, you had started out talking about the five things that you would use as a guideline. The first was the bills would have to have constitutional foundation. Let's talk about the other four now. This is a good place for it.
Okay. No bill to exceed 10 pages. Now, I'll tell you my rationale behind that. You could take the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution, and you could put them on 10 pages of pieces of paper. How can we draft two documents of such great importance that have governed this country for over 200 years, and we can't write a single piece of legislation unless it's 400, 500 or 2,000 or whatever pages long? So no bill to exceed 10 pages. Okay?
I will tell you why. You asked the question. I'm going to tell you the answer. The answer is because we do not have line item veto. If we had line item veto, that would not happen. Congress slides through so much garbage, so much pork into these bills, especially the more popular the bill, the more pork goes along with it. If the president, if the executive branch had line item veto instead of having to veto the whole 10,000-page bill, this would cut out a lot of that crap.
All right. You're going to love my next one. And folks, for those who are listening, no, we did not rehearse this ahead of time. So, item number three, no content shall be in the bill that's not within dealing with the title of the bill.
I like it.
Okay? So, if the bill says it's a bill to build a road, you can't have something in there to put up a statue or study the CC fly or to, you know, do something else. Only the content, the only content in that bill has to pertain to the title of the bill. in the bill can't exceed 10 pages. Listen to the rest. All bills must be written in layman's terms and posted online 7 days prior to introduction. Now, this would exclude bills which deal with constitutionally authorized national security. All bills requiring funds must have a breakdown of the following: the amount projected, how it will be funded, who will fund it, the cost to the taxpayer, and a sunset date. And finally, all bills which show who the beneficiaries are, and who's footing the bill.
Well,
I
see a little bit of that in Washington. When the Department of Energy was asked for an economic impact statement based on one of the regulations that they were passing, I played the clip here on X Squared Radio, and it was the biggest joke I've ever listened to. Having Congress grill this guy over whether they did an economic impact statement. How many jobs is this going to cost? How many jobs will it create? How much will it cost over time? Who's going to be affected? When is it going to end? He had no answers to any of those questions. And Congress could do nothing about it. The regulation went through, and there wasn't a thing they could do about it. I hope that you guys, you go candidates, go hard and get into Washington and make these changes.
Well, I'll tell you, when the people understand, a funny thing happened to me a couple, maybe 2 weeks ago, right after I announced my candidacy, I was talking to some people I work with, and I told them what I was doing, and they had heard my political positions on several issues, but the one thing I drive home is that I believe we cannot ever get back to constitutional government in this country with the current system that only gives us candidates who are about the party and not about the country. So if we are to ever regain our greatness, if we are to ever stop this madness in our debt, we must get back to the Constitution. Now, I also told him, I said, you know, we've got to accept our part of the responsibility as well. We have to be willing to accept that a big part of the problem that we have in this country is that we, for so long, have kind of set back and just closed our eyes and said, okay, the government's giving me this or the government's giving me that. We never questioned where it was coming from. We never stopped and took the time and said, wait a minute, the government has no money. They only get money from someone else. And we never took the time to realize that the life that we were living and the things that we expected that to come from government would eventually have to be paid. And now we see what's happening. We see that every man, woman, and child in this country, you come in, you're born right now, you owe $48,000. That's your part of the national debt, $48,000 for every man, woman, and child in this country. That means if you're a family of four, that you owe almost $200,000 in debt.
And well, a lot of people don't understand
never had
this.
Anything to do with it.
A lot of people don't understand this concept that of national debt compared to personal debt. When the federal government borrows all the money that can be borrowed, all the money that the Fed can possibly print, there's nothing left for small business to borrow. All the money has been borrowed up. So when we look at the trend in the United States of the highest level of single location businesses, this is not like McDonald's or Taco Bell or Belk's or Walmart, where you have a franchise or a national brand that goes all over the nation. I'm talking a single location business, whether it's a mechanic shop or a restaurant. The reason we have more single location businesses now in the United States than ever before is because unemployment is so high that these individuals can't get a job, and so they create a job, their own job. And that's why this trend is occurring. The only thing that's stopping it from actually saving our nation right now is because small business cannot borrow money to get started. There's nothing left to borrow. For exactly the reason that Richard just said, when a child is born, he already has $48,000 in debt that the nation has accumulated in his name.
Question is, what are we going to do about it? Are we going to sit back and wait for the next person to do something? Or, you know, I love to equate what we're doing with GO and what my candidacy is about to our founding fathers, because they, for so long, tried to appease the king. They did everything humanly possible to reach out to this tyrant to make him see the error of his ways. And after over 100 years of this constant abuse and tyranny and the despotism that was employed by this tyrant, they said enough is enough. And we are fast approaching a time in this country, and I carry a little booklet with me. It's called the Citizens Rule Book, and it has the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Ten Commandments, and things to live by. But you ask the average person, have you ever read the Declaration of Independence? And most people say, yeah, well, when I was in school, I read it. And you say, are you aware that if you read it really carefully, that there are a lot of things that we were upset with about the king in declaring our independence that are coming back today? And the one that I love to use is that one of the lines in there is when they're talking about the things that the king was doing, they say, he has sent hither swarms of officers and offices to eat out our substance and harass our people. Now, look at what the government is doing today. They have a plethora of officers and offices that consume our money, our time. They take us to court. They harass us. Isn't it ironic that these are the very things that we declared our independence from?
Isn't it amazing that we have an alienated nation after over 200 years of safe and sane operation? And that somehow the public apathy has become so great that we have allowed the executive branch to become King George. He now has total power. Congress is completely emasculated. If the Senate does not give the president advice and consent on someone he wants to appoint, he appoints them anyway. Nobody can do anything about it. We are at a point, my friends, my fellow Earth explorers, where the Constitution has a process in place to fix this. Richard is part of that fix, part of that citizen representative that goes to Washington and says, enough is enough. Are we going to continue our apathy, or are we going to tell them to get out of our house?
Very well put. And on that note, did you have any other questions about?
No, that's it.
The fair tax.
I've got your 5 points. I've got the fair tax. I think we're pretty down with everything. Tell our listeners, because a lot of them are in North Carolina, but they're all over the country as well, how they can get a hold of GO, how they can get a hold of you, how they can support your candidacy, spread the word, put yard signs out, go vote. How do they get involved?
Well, all the things that you just mentioned, and they can go to our GO website, and they can go for goforlynch.com, which is my North Carolina congressional website right now. We will have another one up, but if they go to goforlynch.com, or if they go to G-O-O-O-H.com, they can find out more about the organization. We welcome the opportunity for people to help any way they can, whether it's the yard signs, making phone calls, putting together speaking engagements, meet and greets. If you belong to an organization and you're in the 9th District, you belong to any type of group or organization or meetup groups, I welcome the opportunity to address your group so that you can get a better understanding of exactly who I am and what I hope to bring to Washington. Monetary contributions to the campaign and to the GO organization are graciously accepted, and we treat every contributor to our organization and to our campaign, whether you're a $5 contributor or a $10,000 contributor, we treat them all the same. Nobody gets any special treatment, and nobody's going to get anything. You know, I love to tell the story that when I was running for governor out in New Jersey, I was addressing this group of senior citizens one night, and there was about seven candidates, and there was a lot of independents. There were seven candidates on the podium that night, and the question was asked, if you're elected governor, what would you do for me? And I happened to be last in line, but as they went down the line, it was funny to hear every one of these candidates trying to reach out to this group, telling them what they were going to do for them. And when it got to me, I looked them right in the eyes, you know, I looked right in the audience, and I said, I will do absolutely nothing for you. I said, but what I will do is work to get government out of your pocket so that you can do for yourself. Because one of the problems we have right now is government takes your money away from you, siphons off so much of it, and then decides to give you back a little bit of it. That's wrong on so many levels. I got standing ovation. So that's what I would like to do in Washington, is to get government out of your life. Government's not supposed to be here to control you. Government is not supposed to be here to take the fruits of your labor. One of my favorite saving things, and I have it on a bumper sticker, and it says, your pursuit of happiness does not entitle you to the fruits of my labor. Because we're living in a society today that government has told the people that you're entitled to certain things, and then told the other people that you must pay your fair share to make sure that they have those entitlements. Understand one thing. Our Declaration of Independence that speaks about man as being endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it doesn't say that you're entitled to happiness. It says you're entitled to it, entitled to pursue it. And we've got things so turned around, and we've allowed it to happen. We've got to go back into Washington. This is a great nation, and we can still get it back in order. I tell people, our founding fathers had a greater job to do than we do right now. Our task is minuscule compared to what they had to do. All we got to do is go into this big, beautiful home that's been built. Yeah, it's been trashed. It needs to be painted. There's some yard work that has to get done. We got to clean it up, but it's got a good, solid foundation. And that's what this country is. We got a great foundation, and it's founded in the Constitution. All we got to do is have the people with the guts to go in and tell the American people the truth and what we have to do to bring it back. I will do that.
I like it. That is what we want to hear. That's the kind of energy, that's the kind of fire in the belly that makes people stand up and cheer. And I appreciate you coming on the program. We'll look for you.
Thank you for having me. I've enjoyed it. I mean, time went by like that.
Well, it's true. And I'll get a hold of you. I've got some other things maybe I can do for you. You know, I used to be a speechwriter for a presidential candidate, and maybe we can pool our resources, as it were, and see if we can't put these other 8 candidates or 9 or 10 candidates on the road and put you in the office. All right? Thank you very much.
That would be great. I appreciate all the help we can get.
No problem. Thank you very much, Richard.
Thank you.
And good luck and good Godspeed.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night. All right. Excellent, excellent. That's what we like to hear. Yes. That's what makes America work. Very good, people. Very good. Let's do this. That's what Richard wants to hear. That's what I would like to see him accomplish. All right, let's go ahead and take a quick break. We'll do a little Sarah, and we'll be back right after this. Don't go away. Be right back with more X Squared Radio.
Make me a witness. Take me out of darkness, out of doubt. I won't weigh it down with good intention. We'll make fire.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. So glad you could join us. We're coming to you live from east of the Appalachian Mountains, an undisclosed location. Thank you very much, Richard Lynch, for coming on the program tonight, telling us about the GO movement, the Get Out of Our House movement. Maybe how we can take control back from the system and give it back to the people where it belongs. By the way, just in post-epilogue to that, One of our listeners, Ted, who is not from this country, but nevertheless very patriotic. The U.S. has become unconstitutional and lawless. How is it that the Department of Justice, Eric Holder, and all the rest of the attorney generals across the country seem to just sit by and watch or ignore the fact while these new and unconstitutional laws get passed week after week? Aren't these people required to take an oath to uphold the Constitution no matter what? If people want to change something that's gone so far, it's probably going to take a revolution. An American spring is brewing. Nicely said, Ted. Thank you very much. Appreciate your words. Don't forget, Alienated Nation is coming out in print next month. I will have a link perhaps next week, show you how you can pre-order the book. You'll get a discount. You'll also get the audio version for free the instant it is ready. Alienated Nation is going to split this thing wide open. And we have a lot of people that are very, very passionate about this subject, but I caution. We are not here to tip over cars, throw rocks, yell and scream, maybe. But we're going to be civilized and constitutional and intelligent, and we will be victorious. Scott from Florida, line two, welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Brooks. Thank you for having Richard on.
My pleasure.
I was rooting for Ron Paul last election, but it appears that maybe he's the one who's the catalyst who we need.
I agree with you.
As a catalyst.
Yeah, I agree with you. When he ran in 2007, he started a movement that went out across the world, ricocheted, came back to the United States, and kind of resulted in the Occupy movement. We're now seeing Turkey, Russia, Spain, all kinds of countries responding to this citizen activism, getting out and just clogging up the streets and saying, hey, what about us? So maybe they do serve a purpose of just being annoying to get us to look at it. But candidates like Richard are what this nation needs, that they will step up and go serve and agree to serve for a limited amount of time and listen to their constituents. That's what Larry Kissel does from our district, the 8th district in North Carolina. I have a lot of Republican friends that are going to vote for Larry Kissel, even though he's a Democrat, because he's a common sense guy, and he often goes against his own party because he comes from labor. He understands what small business is, and I think there are a lot of legislators that are that way, but the vast majority of what we see in the mainstream press allows things like this executive order that got passed the day before yesterday to go unchecked. Is that what you're thinking, Scott?
Well, yes. I was also wanting to thank you about bringing up John Micah, who's really doing an excellent job in Central Florida here. I'm in Daytona Beach. He's doing, he holds town meetings. We know what he's up to. He definitely has, I think, reached out to the schools, the universities, as well as to the city and what they need.
Yeah, just to give you a recap, this was in the very first part of the first hour. Representative Micah is part of the legal action, part of the legislative action that is moving TSA out of the state of Florida. They're doing what the rest of the nation should be doing. They're ejecting these federal agents that have come in to search us up and down and take our money and violate us before we get on airplanes. Now that the federal TSA agents are being rejected from Florida and they're being replaced by state employees who will uphold the regulations and keep our airlines safe, but they won't be proliferating these horror stories that we've been hearing across the nation. And Mr. Micah is one of the leaders that's making that happen.
And was the I think some years back, some libertarians were being stopped in airports. That was by the federal agents, more than likely. I think they were being targeted about 3 years ago in the Midwest. Yes, it needs to happen. We need to take the love of travel back in our country. We seem to have lost that.
I dread it. You know, I fly a lot, and when I go to the airport, you know, I make sure I only have 4 ounces of liquids in there in a baggie and make sure my shoes are not laced up tightly so I can slip them off easily, because you got to get just about, well, disrobed. And you are when you hold your hands over your head and you're radiated by this thing. I got to tell you, I got kind of smart with them a couple times because they've said, you know, thanks for, you know, doing this. And I'd say, you know, I actually feel pretty good because I get to walk away from this thing and you don't. You get to stay here and be irradiated by this machine all day long. I only have to take one dose. You got to take a lot. And they kind of frown at me when I say stuff like that. But I was in a busy airport up in Portland, Oregon. And there was a lady that went through in front of me. This is shortly after Bin Laden had been killed. And all of a sudden, you know, it's kind of a white noise anyway, with a bunch of mumbling and shoes and trays and baskets and change and everything being rattling around, and a couple hundred people going through this scanning process. All of a sudden, you hear this female's voice say, "No, no, I'm not going to do it. You guys are supposed to be going home. Bin Laden is dead. This is all over with now." And this guy was saying, "No, ma'am, there's still a threat, and you know, we still have to do these, you know, to keep our airlines safe." And she looked up and she said something like, I want my airport back," or something like that. And everybody was looking up at this moment. Everything had like frozen in time. And then, then everybody put their head back down, kept putting their belts in the tub and everything, and it went right back to normal. For that split second, I thought, "Oh my gosh, these TSA agents are in big trouble. There's 200 of us and 5 of them." And it didn't happen, but it came that close.
And also the note you just made about the small businesses, it's been really sad to drive around town and see everything that's shut down over the past 4 years, all small businesses.
Is it that way in Florida, too? I thought that was just up here in Kentucky and North Carolina.
No, it's here, too. It's even some of the chains are shutting down. But in general, it's you know, there's a lot of empty space. There's a lot of empty, you know, strip malls with empty space. And it's sad to see it because it just shows the desolation.
I was talking with my congressman the other day, and I asked him, you know, you're out talking to the constituents every day. I'm just a single businessman with my own perspective. What are you hearing out there? And he said, "Brooks, I hear the same story every time I come back to the district." He calls us the district. Hundreds of businessmen, one after the other, telling me the same thing. Get government out of our way so we can create the jobs we're here to do. We can't move. We can't borrow money. We can't sell our stuff. We can't buy our stuff. We can't hire people. We can't do anything. These regulations have us choked to death.
On that note, we need breathing room, and I'll let you go.
All right.
Thank you, Dr. Brooks.
I thank you, Scott.
Bye.
All right. Now, on a lighter note, you know that there have been mysterious Chinese fossils discovered that may be a new human species. It's true. Mysterious fossils of what may be a previously unknown type of human have been uncovered in caves in China. One that possesses a highly unusual mix of bygone and modern human features, scientists reveal. Surprisingly, the fossils are only between 11,500 and 14,500 years old. That means they would have shared the landscape with modern humans when China's earliest farmers were first appearing. Well, Darren Curnow, who's a paleoanthropologist at the University of New South Wales in Australia, says, these new fossils might be of a previously unknown species, one that survived until the very end of the Ice Age around 11,000 years ago. You have any idea how earth-shaking this news is? Of all the caves, of all the sediment beds, of all of the tombs and burial mounds that have been examined over the centuries that we've been digging around and looking for our roots, this cave in China shows a previously unknown species? How many skeletons were in this cave? Not many. It says 3 fossil specimens. And this is the crazy thing. If there's another species, why are there only 3 here, 2 there, 5 there? Another species should be just as populous as any other species. Where did they come from? Were they implanted on this planet? Did they develop on this planet? Did we descend from these? No, it's another species. That's really earth-shaking. Carbon dating, a technique that estimates the radioactive decay of carbon in samples of charcoal found within the fossils, helps establish their age. Charcoal also showed that they knew how to use fire. Stone artifacts found at the Ma Lu Dong site also suggest they were tool makers. So they were smart. They could use tools. They knew how to make fire. They had a jutting jaw and flaring cheeks. Stone Age fossils are usually mosaics of modern and archaic human anatomical features as well as previously unseen characteristics. This makes them difficult to classify as either a new species or an unusual type of modern human. For instance, what they're calling the Red Deer Cave people had long, broad, and tall frontal lobes like modern humans. These brain lobes are located immediately behind the forehead and are linked with personality and behavior. Wow, they had personality. However, the Deer Cave people differ from modern Homo sapiens in their prominent brow ridges, thick skull bones, flat upper faces with a broad nose, jutting jaw, and lack a human-like chin. Brains, modern in size by Ice Age human standards, large molar teeth, which meant they weren't just carnivores, they were omnivores, and primitively short parietal lobes, brain lobes at the top of the head associated with sensory data. These are primitive features seen in our ancestors hundreds of thousands of years ago, Curnow said. Unique features of the Red Deer Cave people seen either in modern nor known archaic lineages of humans include a strongly curved forehead bone, very broad nose and eye sockets, and very flat cheeks that flare widely to the sides to make space for large chewing muscles. So the Red Deer Cave people in China at the end of the Ice Age, they survived the final and one of the worst cold episodes known as the Last Glacial Maximum, which ended about 20,000 years ago. These people survived that. The period around 15,000 to 11,000 years ago when they thrived in southwest China is known as the Pleistocene-Holocene transition, and it saw a shift to climates and ecological communities the same as those of today, which, by the way, were experiencing some amazing climate change right now. It's the warmest winter on record all across the United States. Very, very strange. After 2 years after coming through one of the coldest and snowiest winters, especially in the southeast, just amazingly confusing weather that we're having all over the planet. I have said this month, if it's 80 degrees now, in March in North Carolina, what's it going to be like this summer? That's probably going to be 120 degrees, which would be absolutely devastating. So I want to recap because at the very first hour of this program tonight, I mentioned this executive order that was made, the National Defense Resources Preparedness Executive Order.
The president just signed it 2 days ago. That's March 16th. The news release came out yesterday. It's now showing up in some papers. Fortunately, I am quite the Earth Explorer, and I found this. I'm sure there are executive orders signed every day by presidents, maybe more presidents, some presidents than others. But this one is particularly bothersome because it lays a foundation for what many fear might be martial law. Martial law, as you know, is the seizure of normal public access to things like meeting halls and normal gathering places, and the placement of federal troops into states, cities, and towns in order to maintain order. The general function of this executive order, and it's quite lengthy, it's about 13, 14 pages in length. The general function of this executive order says, executive departments and agencies. Now, I know you know what these mean, right? The departments, agencies, bureaus, I'm going to list them in just a second. There are 17 of them. These agencies responsible for plans and programs relating to national defense or for resources and services needed to support such plans and programs shall. Now, any time an order says shall, it is not a suggestion. This is something you must do, okay? Be prepared. In the event of a potential threat to the security of the United States, to take actions necessary to ensure the availability of adequate resources and production capability, including services and critical technology for national defense requirements. Now, under the implementation of this is where it becomes particularly alarming. The National Security Council and Homeland Security Council, in conjunction with the National Economic Council, three councils made up by appointees by the president, shall serve as the integrated policy-making forum for consideration and formulation of national defense resource preparedness policy and shall make recommendations to the president on the use of authorities under the act. Now, here are the shalls. The Secretary of Homeland Security shall provide for the central coordination of the plans and programs incident to authorities and functions delegated under this order. In other words, that's the clearinghouse. Secretary of Homeland Security, that is Janet Napolitano. Report to the president periodically concerning all program activities. Not to Congress, not to the Senate, not to the Supreme Court, not to the Department of Justice, report to the president. Now, it gets worse. The Secretary of Commerce, in cooperation with the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of Homeland Security, and other agencies, shall analyze potential effects of national emergencies on actual production capability, taking into account the entire production system, including shortages of resources, develop recommended preparedness measures to strengthen capabilities for production increases in national emergencies, and perform industry analysis to assess capabilities of the industrial base to support the national defense and develop policy recommendations to improve the international competitiveness of specific domestic industries. Specific domestic industries. And their abilities to meet national defense program needs. So, when we talk about this, all these departments, all these bureaus, all these agencies are going to be cleared through Homeland Security and Commerce. Now, the interesting thing about this is they're going to determine what are critical materials, which could be oil, could be other things. And then they're going to be able to implement
by executive order under this new regulation that has just been passed, the following leaders, the Secretary of State, Treasury, Defense, the Attorney General, Secretary of Interior, Agriculture, Commerce, Labor, Health and Human Services, Transportation, Energy, Homeland Security, Director of National Intelligence, Director of the Central Intelligence Agency, notice there's no FBI, Chair of the Council of Economic Advisors, notice there's no Council of Governors, the Administrator of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, and the Administrator of General Services. The General Services Administration is the biggest buyer of world goods in the world. They operate 225,000 vehicles. They buy everything from pencil erasers to jet motors. And it's the General Services that administers this. Small business need not apply. So it covers food resources. It covers power generation. It covers health resources. It means drugs, medical devices, etc. National defense, and there are certain offsets. The purchase, the offset means a compensation practice required as a condition of purchase in either government or commercial sales of defense articles and or defense services as defined by the Arms Export Control Act. So this piece of law goes on and on and on, and it's signed by Barack Obama, March 16, 2012. This gives the president sweeping powers over the resources of the United States, over the resources using things like price and wage freeze authority, which has been given to him. It's been renewed to him. And so that's what we were talking about tonight in the first hour, and we brought Richard Lynch on, who's a candidate for GO. GO is G-O-O-O-H, which stands for Get Out of Our House. Now, there are 32 states that have passed sovereignty acts to declare state independence from federal government. A sovereignty act is, if you go and look up the various sovereignty acts that have been passed state by state, and I'll tell you what the importance of this is in just a moment. These sovereignty acts are equivalent to and function like the nullification acts which were passed prior to the Civil War, the war between the states, the recent unpleasantness. These nullification acts allowed the state governments to tell the federal government, those laws that you are passing that will function in our state must be ratified by our state legislature, by our state legislators, before it will be enforced in our state. Now, some states are doing this on healthcare. We now see Florida is doing this on the TSA. They're in the process of ejecting the TSA agents from the state of Florida. I'm sure Texas will follow. I'm sure South Carolina will follow. I'm sure that those states that are aware that there is now precedent that you can now throw the TSA agents out of your state and take back over your own airports, I'm sure many more will follow. These sovereignty acts are important. The fact that there are 32 is important. We need 37. Why? We need 5 more states to pass sovereignty acts, bringing it to 37. 37 out of 50. We need 37 because that's 2/3 of 50. 37 states make up a ratifying body of states. This means that the 37 states could get together on their own without federal assistance. They could form amendments that they wish to make to the Constitution. They could have a constitutional convention they can pass the amendment, and they can ratify the amendment all in one day because there will already be 37 states signed on. Once that amendment is passed, it becomes part of the Constitution. They can also rescind amendments that have been made to the Constitution. Once this convention is opened, it can do whatever it wants to do. But these states are smart, and they're targeted, and they see what the problem is. The problem is exactly what the Founding Fathers thought would be the problem in our day. A lot of people say, well, that was the Founding Fathers. They weren't really looking for our day. How could they imagine a society like ours? How could they imagine something so large and so complex and have such a gross national product? Let me tell you something. These Founding Fathers came from Britain. The British was the largest empire the world has ever seen. The sun never set on it. It had the largest navy. It had the largest army. It had the largest budget of any nation up until modern times. They were very familiar with big government. They were very familiar with a monarch controlling everything, and his dukes and his earls and his vassals and his appointees and his cronies controlling everything, controlling the money supply, controlling defense, controlling commerce, setting the prices, adding taxes, and there's no representation. There's no going to the king saying, oh, you know, by the way, that tea tax, we don't really like it, and we'd like to see it rescinded. The king ruled by divine right. What he said was law because he was the law. What the Founding Fathers said is that's no longer going to fly, okay? We're going to have a different government that's set up from the foundation of the Magna Carta. We're going to declare a set of unalienable rights, things that no government can take away and no government can give because they don't have the authority or the ability to give them. They're given by God. So they founded a government that had three branches that were supposed to be co-equal. The executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judicial branch. Over the centuries that this country has survived, it has always been one of those branches that has seemed to set the balance. When the Supreme Court got out of hand, it was the president that went to the bully pulpit and made his case to the people and was able to appoint another justice in due time and make a change. When Congress got out of hand, it was the president that stepped in and made things, you know, provided the leadership to inspire them to make things happen. When the president got out of hand or was incapacitated, it was the Congress that stepped forward. It was the Speaker of the House that assumed the role as president under a series, progressive authority plan. All of these branches seem to balance one another. But over the years, since 1932, after the crash, the Great Depression of 1929, Roosevelt enacted a series of agencies, departments, and bureaus. These were done almost by fiat. They were passed by Congress because we were at a point of no hope. Government needed to become a massive employer, a massive provider of national vision and function. And that's what they did. They moved in and established what became the USDA, the FDIC, the Federal Reserve, on and on. It was almost like these agencies were in a box. They came out so quickly. They put people back to work, created soup lines, built bridges and roads and power stations. They built buildings and dams and created waterways. People went to work, and they went to work quickly. It is arguable as to whether the nation would have recovered on its own. I believe that it would. Many do believe that it would have anyway. But government saw an opportunity, and it stepped in. Roosevelt served for an unprecedented, unequaled, never repeated, three terms.
12 years. And during that period, the professional voter was created. The professional voter, the person that would go to the polls and vote a certain way so that he could make sure he continued to get a check. Every single time we have gone to war and come out, we've had a post-war recession, these kinds of relief programs became stronger and stronger and stronger. This kind of link between the elected official and the electorate became stronger and stronger and stronger. People needed a check. Government needed a voter. It was pretty easy to draw the two together. Now, in these last days, with mass communication being instantaneous, with or without a budget, it became necessary to take control of the voting process. State after state after state filled with voter fraud. Voters that are bussed from place to place to place. They vote over and over and over again. Many states have no identification process, no tracking process. They don't want one, won't allow one, challenge it in court. Why would they hold to something so antiquated, so crazy, as to let an anonymous person walk up to any poll they wish, claim that they're John here, George there, Sally there, Fred here, Bill there, and vote again and again and again? Why would we possibly hold on to a system like that? Because the very people that are being elected by that process want that process to survive. When that becomes politically incorrect, socially unsustainable, then they create a system whereby the votes are tallied electronically. Last week we played testimony for you of a programmer who had been asked by the Speaker of the House of the state of Florida to write a program that would flip a vote at the voting box, that it would be tallied differently than the way it was cast, and that the machines that were used to make that vote were flipped at the same time the tally was flipped so they would cross-check. In essence, in doing this, although the programmer refused to write the program, he came to Congress, came to the Senate, you heard it as I played it here for you last week, and told them that these programs were being written, that they could be written, and they could never be traced. To make matters worse, I reminded you that SCYTL, S-C-Y-T-L, an international vote tallying software company, bought SOE. SOE was the software company that tallied votes for over 200 precincts around our country, numerous states. SCYTL bought DOE outright, or SO outright. They bought SOE outright. Now those votes, instead of being cast in Pennsylvania, cast in Ohio, cast in Georgia or California or Florida, instead of those votes being tallied in the United States under a secure system, those votes are now tallied in Europe by a company that is owned by a small group of VCs, venture capitalists. Those venture capitalists have on their boards Wall Street. Wall Street controls the vote tallying software that counts the votes of all the people in the precincts of the United States. It has come to the point where the realization that no matter how you vote, how it is counted will decide the election. It is quite possible that the executive branch and the powers that are already in power in the legislature, the Congress and the Senate, can never be removed because the corruption system is in place. I'm not saying the system is corrupt. I'm saying the corruption system is in place. A simple program that deletes itself as soon as its nefarious work is done could easily be put into this system and never be traced. This is why it is important for these 32 states to grow to 37 states that have signed sovereignty acts. These states
need to create an amendment or rescind an amendment in the Constitution so that the Supreme Court has the authority from the Constitution and the amendment that will be placed upon it to make decisions to rein in the executive branch and the legislative branch that have gotten out of control. It can happen, but it requires action on the part of the states. You can go find out which states have passed sovereignty acts. Tennessee has one. Texas has one. I can't list all the states to you from memory, but I can tell you that there are 18 states out there that have not signed them. We need 5 more states in order to have this be facilitated. Once these 5 states have signed sovereignty acts, they can now act as a ratifying body to form a constitutional convention and pass 2 amendments that are key. Obviously, one thing has been built upon and built upon again and built upon again, and now it doesn't resemble the Constitution. The president is allowed to have a cabinet. The cabinet is a team of advisors. They're experts in certain areas that agree with him. But that has grown into a system of secretaries. That has been added onto again by a group of czars, direct appointees by the president. No advice and consent, no representation. These individuals report to and follow only the executive branch, and they control over 60% of the federal budget. What is their natural tendency? Their natural tendency is to perpetuate their own organization. So if there's a movement that says we're going to remove the Department of Energy or greatly reduce it so that it only handles, say, nuclear power, you're no longer going to have the budget and all the floors and floors and floors and offices full of people that do nothing except spend money. They'll be able to get rid of the Department of Education. Over $1 billion a year in the Department of Education, and they don't educate one single student. Ron Paul is correct. We need to cut $1 trillion from our budget the first year. I'm not talking about a 10-year plan. I'm not talking about a 5-year or 8-year phase-in plan. First year, any corporation that wants to gain control of their losses, of their poor profitability, which is where we're at, the very first thing you do is go in and lay off people. We do not need to be expanding the federal payroll right now. We need to be cutting it. We need to be going department by department as a Congress representing the people. They need to go slash these agencies. So the amendment would be something like the agency amendment. And what this would do is it would forbid the federal government from forming any agency, any department, any bureau to do those things which should be done by the states. All 17 of those departments that I mentioned, all of them, every single one of them would be dissolved under this amendment. The only one that would remain would be the Department of Defense. That is something that's constitutionally allowed. The rest of them, if they wanted to exist, they have to go to the states and get the budgets that it takes to keep those organizations going. But they would no longer be run by the federal government. They would answer to a gubernatorial council, a council established by governors of states that are served by those agencies. And that council should rotate so that no set of states becomes the crony masters of the economic system. The next amendment that needs to pass is one that removes the power of the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is a private organization that resides in Europe. It's made mostly of European banks. The reason this amendment needs to take care of this is exactly what formed at the end of World War I. And you can read about it in my new book, Alienated Nation. There were two bankers, Hawes and Young. And what these two bankers did is they worked their way into the committees, the actual committees in Congress, where they could influence what was being done with the reparations of Germany and what was being done to retool Germany. Now, you'll remember after the Treaty of Versailles that Germany was saddled with huge amounts of reparations. In other words, we had a war, we blew a bunch of stuff up, and you're going to pay to fix it because it was your fault. Well, that treaty 100% guaranteed that we were going to have another war. It absolutely made it impossible not to have another war. These two bankers went in and financed Germany's reparations. They worked to gain control of the committees economically. And they allowed German industrialists in the United States to become huge and powerful. They brought over German factory engineers and let them tour the Ford Motor Company, our aircraft plants, our best manufacturing techniques, take those back to Germany. And then these two banks funded the building of these plants so that they can make tanks and airplanes and guns and cannons and weapons. These two bankers literally made enormous fortunes off of the German buildup to war. So the Germans go pound the crap out of Guernica, which was a small Basque town, to test the Blitzkrieg in April. And then they turned right around and took a week and went and defeated Poland. The Blitzkrieg was proven. There was no front. There were no ditches. There was no prolonged taking pot shots over a minefield at each other. This machine was built to go to war and do it very quickly. And it was successful. Then those same two bankers, using their money resources and all the cash that they were making off Germany, decided to finance the American war effort as well. So these two guys made huge amounts of money. Today we would call it trillions of dollars. Huge amounts of money feeding weapons to both sides. That needs to end. And that is what the amendment would be designed to do. End the ability of industrialists and huge banking concerns from making money off of war. We could, with two amendments, make war economically unfeasible for any country. And imagine what would happen if we took the amount of money that we're spending to war against each other and used it for exploration, used it for energy, used it for food production exploration. And I don't mean Monsanto. I mean taking control of the system by allowing the private sector to take control of it and make it function. It could happen. It's going to take a tremendous amount of work. It's going to take a tremendous amount of faith and self-discipline so that when this convention opens, it doesn't get crazy. We start throwing all kinds of amendments on there about marriage and you name it. You could throw all kinds of stuff on there. Making English the official language of the United States. How ridiculous of a thing. I never heard of such a thing. Protecting the American flag by not letting people burn it. I mean, let's get real, people. Get seriously real. Two things need to be added and maybe one thing removed from the Constitution. You're hearing about it right here on X Squared Radio. You could participate in this. We have about 4 minutes left. You can call me at 888-429-5471. Also, as you're making your plans this summer, don't forget Maya 2012 coming up in December. But don't wait. When you get that refund check, you get that windfall this this summer. There's a couple of months that have five paychecks in them. Use one of the paychecks. Go to Maya 2012 and get yourself registered. I want to see you in Chichen Itza. You might as well be at ground zero for this 2012 thing and have some amazing stories to tell. If you don't have a passport, you don't want to fly, you don't want to meet us in Houston, go down with us on the 13th, come back on the 22nd. I promise to have you home by Christmas, and the stories you will have to tell will be phenomenal. If you don't want to do that, you can go to the Midwest Conference called the Pythagoras Conference. You could drive to it. You could take a bus to it. This conference is inexpensive, and I'm giving you an additional $100 off. All you have to do is go to xsquaredradio.com, click on the blue Pythagoras Conference link, and it will take you to the website, and you'll be able to sign up. Now, I want to make sure that you got a couple other things going for you. Don't forget to register to vote. You can do it. Participate in the process. Read about the candidates. Choose whoever you want. But at least let's participate in the system and be represented. Also, Alienated Nation is going to be coming out next month in April in print. It'll be at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever fine books are sold. This is a crossover book. It is sort of a political self-help book. It's going to tell you a lot of what's going on right now in very plain speak, okay? Not a lot of political Felder garb. It's not a right-wing conspiracy book. It's not a left-wing conspiracy book. There's no conspiracy theories in it. It tells you how the nation has become alienated from its own government. First of all, what kind of government we have right now. It's also going to tell you how you can fix it. So it's an extremely timely book. It'll cost $14.95. You'll be able to get a discount if you register early. As soon as it goes into print, I will send you the discounted copy, and you get the audio version for free. So if you're not a great reader, don't worry about it. It will be available on Nook and Kindle as well. So pay attention. Alienated Nation coming out in print. This is going to set the place on fire. You might as well have your copy. So it's 10 till. We're done for this week. Thank you so much for participating, for listening. I don't know what's going to be on next week, but I promise you it's going to be fun. Tune in to X Squared Radio and Get Squared. Don't forget to tell your friends out there. Thank you so much.
It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.